How Did You Think of That? With Temple Grandin.
And I'm Sherry Quinn. We seek out innovators, educators, and researchers who approach challenges with their own unique abilities, such as the way Temple Grandin uses visual thinking to approach problems and discover solutions. Big is Fragile is our theme on this episode of How'd You Think of That? Grandin talks to Erin Creer.
I'm a coordinator and an instructor for the agriculture program here at Allen Hancock Community College.
Creer teaches animal and plant science, agriculture business, and sustainable agriculture. The college operates a small student farm, complete with a vineyard.
We have a bonded winery on campus where they make wine from those grapes.
They also have a fruit orchard, a greenhouse for seed germination projects, and a vegetable garden in collaboration with the city of Santa Maria in California. Students can experiment with growing a variety of crops, including perennial grains and a no-till plot.
We do a lot of just kind of wacky things that are fun to experiment with that you might not get away with in the industry if you're trying to make a living, you know, but we get to experiment with them and see how they work and how they what doesn't work and let students get exposed to some of those alternative.
Well, the thing that's really good is what you're doing can take a young person and get them all excited about innovating something out in ag. Because
right.
I found that in every career, the big guys don't innovate. Little
right.
guys innovate.
Uh-huh. And I have to tell you, it is an extraordinary honor to me because I talk about you in my animal science class, and I'm just like, I'm thrilled to get a chance to meet
you. Oh, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you.
There is a transformation taking place on many farms across the U.S. After decades of large-scale industrial agriculture dominating the country's food system, the downsides of factory farming are increasingly apparent. For example, during the start of the COVID pandemic, producers were forced to euthanize millions of pigs, chickens, and turkeys because slaughterhouses either shut down or dramatically slowed production, causing a backlog with nowhere for the animals to go. Other examples include the use of chemical pesticides and fertilizers in enormous amounts that can damage the soil, water, air, and climate. One disruption in a giant food supply chain can have ripple effects across the country. So when it comes to agriculture, big can be fragile. That's where sustainable farming comes in. Farms of all sizes are producing a diverse range of foods that are well suited to the local environment where they are grown, leading to a more resilient system that adapts more easily to droughts, floods, and diseases. One trend gaining traction in sustainable agriculture is integrating livestock with crops and what's called precision agriculture. Grandin and Creer discussed the challenges of both big agriculture and sustainable farming and ways people with different approaches and from a diversity of disciplines can work together on solutions.
Well, I'm a big proponent of sustainable ag. We've got to change a lot of things. I was just reading my new science magazine this morning,
uh-huh.
and problems with bees having impaired foraging from
yeah.
various chemicals in the environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my favorite class to teach. That's the one I was actually hired originally to teach, and it's my favorite topic. It's so exciting. Lots of different things that we're trying to do in the industry to make things
better. We've got to stop, you know, putting so many chemicals on things, rotate a lot more crops.
Yep.
I'm happy to see as I travel around, you know, more crop rotation. Need to get some cover crops with cattle on it in with those corn and soybeans.
Exactly.
Got yep. to start doing that.
Yeah, the incorporation of livestock into the cropping system is really like it's a waste not to do that.
We've got to do that.
Yeah.
And you know, everybody's bashing livestock as being really charitable. But if we use our grazing animals right,
mm-hmm.
they improve land.
Oh, exactly.
It's very, very local. Something that works somewhere, one place doesn't work somewhere else.
Exactly.
What I'm finding on the visual thinking, my kind of thinking versus the math thinking, they are different approaches to problem solving.
Right.
And we need to have both.
Well, it's kind of like what we talk about in sustainable agriculture is that diversity is resilience, right? With crops and with animals.
That's right.
And it's the same thing with people. Diversity in ways of thinking and ways of knowing and ways of working, that's where the good work will happen.
And I give talks to big corporations about diversity and different kinds of thinking. And I always get asked this question, what's the first thing we have to do? Is that the first thing you have to do is recognize that different kinds of thinking exist.
Right.
When I was in my 20s. I didn't know that other people thought verbally. I didn't know that. So the first step is understanding that different thinking exists, mm-hmm. and look at how these skills are complementary. Right. In a food processing plant, for example, we need the mathematicians will do the boilers and refrigeration. All the people I worked with, we didn't touch that stuff. We didn't understand it.
Yeah.
But you have to have that. And my department is inventing all the mechanically clever equipment. Think packaging machine. Think inside of the copier, how it feeds the paper. And then the verbal thinkers help keep us organized. I'm a bottom-up thinker.
Yeah.
Here's a specific example of something that works. Here's another specific example of something that absolutely did not work. Then I tend to categorize. All right, let's say it's stuff with integrated agriculture. Well, here's something where we did this cover crop. It got frost and poisoned a bunch of cattle. You certainly don't want that to happen. This is why it's so important to get really good local advice
right.
from experienced people. I'm looking way in the future. Where do I think livestock industry is going to be? I think the graziers have got a good future. Uh-huh. We've got so much land that can only be grazed. We need to get the grazers and the crops back together, because I've talked to people that are doing some rotational grazing and they can drastically reduce the chemical use.
For sure. And the chemical fertilizers that now they can't even get because they're tied up in Russia, right? So,
well, that's the problem. Yeah. And my approach is you don't ban the chemicals. What right. we need to be doing, I've actually heard some really progressive people, something's going to be too pure. Mm-hmm. Say we just ban everything. No, what we need to be doing is drastically reducing their use.
Apparently, and I didn't really realize this. Of course, you don't realize it, you know, until it happens, but I didn't realize how much of our supply of chemical fertilizers comes from Russia. And so with the conflict, Russia has cut off their shipments of chemical fertilizers. So this doesn't affect organic producers, but the conventional farmers now have no access to chemical fertilizers. And I was talking with a student of mine last week who works for a fertilizer and chemical company here that applies materials to farms. And they said that they can't even really adequately give quotes to farmers on how much it's going to cost for a fertilizer application, because it's so up in the air about whether they're even going to have access to it. And if they do, it's going to be very expensive because there's limited supply. And that's one of the things that I've heard most recently.
Well, actually, the prices of some of those fertilizers went way up. Like a year ago, even.
Right.
And the prices were very, very high. And about 4 years ago, we had an agronomist come to our animal science department and give a talk on how the grazing animals, such as the bison, created our best farmland in Iowa and Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And that was a giant light bulb moment. We've got to get the crops and the animals back together.
Yeah, because there's your fertilizer. And
we've got already here. And then you won't need so many chemicals.
Right. Absolutely.
And people are starting to do things like this. You know, let's look at things like antibiotic-free chicken. I've done a little consulting on that. And I do have to give you my conflict of interest. I have been paid some significant amount of money by the chicken industry. Uh-huh. Now, in sustainable ag with livestock, I have no conflict of interest.
Right.
Nobody's paying me for that.
You should, because what you have to offer is really valuable.
I'm just doing my disclosure. That I've got to disclose, yeah. But one of the things that they're finding is Chick-fil-A, for example, got up to 90% antibiotic-free. And uh-huh. then you've got 90% of the flocks are antibiotic-free. Uh-huh. But then what do you do about the flocks that get sick? Just let them die?
Right. No. Right.
No, you're going to give those the antibiotics. Now, that meat is perfectly good to eat.
Right.
That's not where the problem is. Where the problem is with all this antibiotics being fed to farm animals is it's being put out on the land. Poop on dirt. That's where the problems are. And I've read some very scary papers about swine manure, some in other countries, some here, being put out on the fields and mixing in with the microbes in the soil in scary ways. Mm-hmm. You want to lay awake at night, go onto Google Scholar and type in manure and antibiotics. Most of these papers have been in the last 10 years.
Okay.
And they will make you lay awake at night. Antibiotic laced poop.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I didn't even think about that before.
That's got to stop. And then we try to get better and better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And you rotate crops. You won't need to use so much, chemical fertilizer. You won't need to use so much Roundup. You know, so my approach is we don't ban these chemicals, but drastically reduce the use. And some of the things I was reading, and I did an article on sustainability, another one of my books, Improving Animal Welfare, Practical Approach.
Uh-huh.
I've got a chapter in this on sustainability. And I actually referenced some of the articles where we discuss a hybrid approach. Mm-hmm. We're kind of taking the best of regular and the rest of organic, kind of combining it. And I've talked to some very innovative farmers and grazers, and they go, you know, you can always be too pure. That's counterproductive. Sort of like take the best of both and drastically reduce chemical use.
Yeah, we've talked about that in crop production too. I've had that conversation for years with some research scientists that I worked with, and we've talked about that. You know, what if you don't use these chemicals most of the time? But you reserve them for, you know, to save an entire crop or a herd or a flock or whatever.
To save a crop or to, you know, don't let a whole house full of chickens die a miserable death. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that's interesting on the chicken thing is when this first started 10 years ago, all the chicken veterinarians are going, well, this is totally impossible. You're just not going to be able to do it. Well, it turned out it wasn't totally impossible. Mm-hmm. It may be totally impossible to do it 100%. Maybe we can get it to better than 90%, but it'll never be 100%. And the other thing with broilers, you know, they're very, very, very efficient, is you have to do everything right with broilers. You make one little misstep in the process, then you're going to get have birds that are going to have some big problems. You got to do every step in the process right. Some people say, well, livestock are evil. We shouldn't be eating them. And as I learn more about this cropping thing, they're part of the land.
They are.
Especially our grazing animals, herbivorous animals, and they made the land.
Right.
Some of the best crop land in this country. This is an example of the importance of going across disciplines.
Oh, absolutely. That is so very true.
We get too much in our own box. And I was just at two big veterinary conferences, and you know, medical people get in the box. I went to the trade show and I looked at all the latest imaging equipment, x-ray equipment. I said, it's about time you got up to airport quality. It took you 20 years. You finally got there. It's like, but that's just an example of being so stuck in a box. I mean, you didn't see it.
Right.
Like, you got to be kidding. They finally now on the standard x-ray machine have airport quality images.
I'll be darned.
And all you had to do that is use image enhancement software, and that's all you had to do. It's all software. That's right. Been around for 25 years. How could you be that locked in the box that you didn't see that?
It happens in every discipline, like you said.
This is the problem. I know it's a cliche to talk about thinking outside the box, but one thing I've tried to do is, you know, look across disciplines.
I do a lot of that here. I spend a lot of time connecting with, because once you start, you know, in the real world, nobody's working. Well, they shouldn't be anyway. Nobody's working just within one discipline. You know, you're always going to have this collaboration on anything. That's the way the world works. It's integrated. And so it's so important at the college level too, to make sure that we're integrating our programs so that students understand that connectedness.
Precision agriculture is gaining traction. This approach can yield more accurate and controlled results when growing crops and raising livestock. The use of information technology and things like GPS guidance, satellites, robotics, and drones are key components.
So trying to really like precisely apply the water, like where it's needed and when it's needed, so that you're not just, you know, applying it to the entire field at the same time at the same rate, because maybe the plants don't actually need it. And that's true for pesticide applications and fertilizer applications also. Instead of spraying a whole field, you know, with an insecticide, maybe there's only an aphid population in part of the field, and you can target that population using, you know, the drone technology with the sensors, where you can actually sort of use that technology to identify the problem parts of the field and then target your applications to that, so that you're not applying insecticide across an entire field. That's you right. Just need it right here.
Well, and I've been looking up some stuff on satellite technology, because a lot of the work that I do is with big customers. So let's say I want to make sure they're rotating their crops. Well, I can look at that on a satellite, like Axar Technologies.
Right.
We've been seeing a lot of their pictures recently, and they can't lie to me, because one of the problems you get in is people faking up records. I just got in a discussion the other day about how many chickens you have in a barn. And in a training session, they were doing a complicated numerical formula for determining the amount of chickens by the area of the barn. I go, wait a minute, they lie to me about how many chickens is in a barn. I can tell you a simpler way on broilers, really simple way. Make sure they haven't stuffed too many broilers in a barn, is on the day of catch, when they're going to pick them up, You walk in there, and those broilers, when I walk through them, they better be able to move away 1 yard or 1 meter away from me without piling. And then if it's tight, just take a picture of it with your phone and document it.
Yeah.
And they can't fake that. You see, that's the other thing. The other thing I can tell is if the farmer's never walked his birds, they'll be tame up around the door, but then I go in the back of the building, they're going to pile up and go berserk because you know they haven't been walking them.
Right.
See, and those are the kind of things I like to teach the auditors to do, where it's very simple, but you see they're visual things. Where doing it mathematically, they can just lie to you about how many birds are in a building. I mean,
of course.
I can't count chickens in a building. There's no way.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Just go with the visual thing, and you got too many in there, you can't walk through them. They should kind of part like the Red Sea and leave some space.
In a different scenario, imagine a farm where the poultry and livestock are integrated with crops and orchards. Creer and Grandin discussed the benefits of this approach, as well as the challenges. Grandin also suggests some new strategies for a steady agricultural supply chain.
Like almond orchards or deciduous fruit orchards, and you bring in grazing animals during the dormant season, then you don't have to worry about them, you know, eating the tender young leaves or anything like that. And they just clean up the rows in between and also bring their nice fertilizer along and help the soil in so many ways. So for me, the easiest fit would obviously be the perennial orchards and vineyards. They use a lot of goats over here but in vineyards during the dormant season to keep the weeds down. And while at the same time, you know, they're fertilizing the vineyard. It's a little more challenging with annual crops. You have to make sure you have like a fencing system in place, obviously. If you're going to rotate in with some livestock between your plantings, then you have to have a way to contain them. And most of our farmers, you know, our annual crop farmers don't have that kind of like fencing set up, but you could bring in, you know, temporary fencing. I mean, it's definitely doable, but a little more work, I think, than then.
Well, this is the problem. Farming's gotten too specialized.
Yeah, exactly.
Where and monoculture. See, the problem with monoculture is in the short run, it works great. In the long run, you wreck the soil. And
that's exactly what I said.
In the long run, it doesn't work. And this is something that's got to be changed. The other thing we've got to worry about is you need good perimeter fences, depending upon what state. If you're in an open range state and your cattle got out or your goats got out and somebody hit them, you're not liable. But in other states, let's say the cattle busted out, somebody hits them, then you get sued. So that's going to make a farmer, you know, really reluctant, you know, a crop farmer reluctant to do it. But I think the end thing, we have got to get the grazing animals and the crops together. And I'm reading these things all the time.
There's more and more work being done on that.
In fact, right now, there's problems where they can't get enough organic supply. So there's some temptation to do some cheating, like intimidating auditors and things like that. It's just not okay. And this sort of hybrid approach is the future is probably going to be the way to go. And those drastically reduce all the chemicals, drastically reduce the antibiotic use, but you don't ban it. That'd be sort of more my approach. Yeah. I talked to a pig farmer about 10 years ago who retired, and he decided that he'd start some cover crops with some cattle. And he goes, oh, it's wonderful. I didn't have to use any Roundup. And I go, yeah, you got Roundup. Yeah, comes in corrals.
Right. Exactly. And then you have another commodity also, right? Like if you're the producer and you diversify what you're growing, then if you have a disease that takes out your plants, or you have an early frost that, you know, cuts down on your productivity or whatever, if you have some animal it's incorporated into your production system, then you've economically diversified too. You know, it's not only beneficial like for the ecology of the system, but also for the economy of the system.
Well, the other thing we learned during COVID with big agriculture, big is fragile.
Yeah.
And about 5 years ago, before COVID hit, we had some floods here that knocked out some bridges, knocked out some stuff. We saw some stripped shelves. And that's where I thought big is fragile. And there were a lot of people in big ag, well, Temple's like being kind of silly about this big is fragile stuff. But now, after COVID shut down two of the big packing plants, 300,000 head of pigs in the upper Midwest had to be destroyed on the farm.
I know.
Wasted all that food.
Right.
Some of them were killed in really bad methods. Mm-hmm. People got completely PTSD'd and stressed out, having to kill all those pigs. It was absolutely horrible. And that was an example of big is fragile. Now, when big works, it works great. And when big works, you can have good welfare. You can do all kinds of good things. But when it breaks, now big is cheaper.
Yes.
Until you break it. See, this is the paradox. The economy of scale makes that pork cheaper. Now, if you diversify the supply chain, the pork will be more expensive, but it doesn't break as easily. And in an article that I wrote on COVID and the pork industry that you can find online, I found an article about a book, it was in the Wall Street Journal, about how plants evolved on their supply chain management. And maybe we need to take some ideas from the plant. The primitive plant, the ginkgo, you just got these veins. So if you rip the leaf, you know, that part of the leaf's not going to get any water, any nutrition. So the more modern plants have a more convoluted supply chain. It's more expensive to build, but if you rip the leaf, there's another source of water and nutrients.
Yeah,
the plants decided to go with a more diversified supply chain. And we've got a lot of people now building smaller meatpacking plants, but they've got to have a niche. They can't compete head-to-head with the big boys. They've got to have a niche that they can get into, you know, locally owned.
Right.
And people are getting more interested in this.
Yeah, there's some work around here being done on that too, trying to get some local processing, even some mobile processing units out into play for these smaller.
Well, I think the mobile units, most of those are going to get parked. But the advantage of that mobile unit, since it is a trailer, this gives you some real advantages on enabling you to get into a slaughter plant for a fraction of the cost. Right. Also, since it is a trailer, it also is helpful in permitting issues.
Yeah,
I think most of them are going to get parked. It just doesn't pay to move them around, but they're a really good way to get started.
Freer explains another shift happening, a movement towards introducing more perennial crops to reduce soil disturbance that occurs with the constant overturning of annual crops.
And so they can be really beneficial for soil health to have a perennial in place. So there's a lot of work being done in plant breeding to try to get some of those annual crops like wheat and oats, you know, some of those grains to be able to be grown perennially so that you're just harvesting the seed and you keep the roots in place and you keep the stock in place. And that's some of the new breeding stuff that's happening. And then, of course, the other thing that's happening with breeding for sustainable cultivars would be breeding for drought tolerance. That's a major concern, obviously, or also for disease resistance. There's a lot of plant breeding, and I don't mean necessarily GMO, but like just standardized plant breeding, old-fashioned plant breeding to develop cultivars that are resistant to disease, that maybe can tolerate insect pressure a little bit better and still be, you know, give you a good harvest. And then, of course, those that are drought tolerant, that don't require as much water input in order to still be productive. So as far as the species, I don't think there's necessarily any that are more sustainable than others, but it's that those cultivars that have some of that those resistant and resilient traits, the hardiness that we've kind of bred out of our crops when we've created them to be, you know, really, really productive and good at shipping or whatever. We lost a lot of that genetics that made them resilient to these environmental changes. So
I like to look at crop breeding and animal breeding sort of like a national budget.
Yeah.
And if you make the mistake of putting all of your genetic effort into the economy, which would be growth, meat, milk, eggs, then you shortchange infrastructure, which in livestock is the skeleton. You get my confirmation. Your reproduction. You probably also shortchange your military.
Right.
The ability to fight off insects, ability to fight disease.
Yeah.
All of these things require energy. Nothing is free. And there's some people say, well, I'm going to make a plant or make an animal that's super productive, super skeleton, super repro, super resistant to disease. You know what? You're going to need a feed IV or a fertilizer IV.
Right.
To feed all that stuff.
That's a great analogy. I like that.
And right now, there's people that are trying to genetically modify plants and animals to do all three of these things. Mm-hmm. And you won't be able to find enough fertilizer to feed it.
Right.
Right now, a broiler chicken that grows really fast. You have to feed them synthetic methionine. In other words, you've got a high-octane bird that grows really fast. And octane's an old-fashioned way of the best gasolines for cars, high-octane. And you've got to feed it extra stuff to support what you've selected.
That's so true.
And modern broilers, if they don't get synthetic methionine, they're in trouble. That bird needs extra nutrition. And this is something people think they can somehow just beat that. But the problem is, immune function, infrastructure, skeleton, and repro, and products, whether it's crop or whether it's an animal product, all this stuff requires energy. We have to look at what's optimal, not maximum.
That's a good
point. People have a very hard time doing that. Like we got into a real problem with leg conformation with pigs until it got really bad. Then 20 years later, the cattle industry repeated the same mistake, same defects, post-legged, twisted, walking on the two claws. And I remember talking to one breeder maybe 10 years ago, maybe a little longer than that. He was getting into leg problems. And he said, I breed for economically important traits. He thought I was crazy. Let me tell you, he's singing a totally different tune today. Some of this stuff. 10 years ago, he blew me off. Well, he's not doing that now.
That's good. Yeah.
Have we piqued your interest? If you are considering a career in agriculture, Grandin and Creer have some advice.
A lot of students get really upset. Well, I didn't get to go to top school. You know what? My first two schools that I went to were not top schools. I went to a tiny little startup college that barely had started for 2 years. It wasn't even accredited when I went there. But I had a great math teacher. He tutored me in his office. And Ian Sinclair, the chemistry teacher who came out of industry, he tutored me in his office. I had some very good teachers there. And then I went to Arizona State for my animal science, and the department at Arizona State's been disbanded. And then, of course, the University of Illinois was a top school. But I went to two schools that definitely were not top schools. And I told those students that I just was talking to that you can go to, let's say, one of these new ones that starts up. You'll get a good education there. You don't have to go to a top school to have a really good career. And the thing out in the community colleges is they got teachers like you, Aaron, that can really get students on the right path.
We hope so. Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to go to Harvard to have a successful career.
Not at all. No. In fact,
it's nice to go to a top school, but if you don't get into one, it's not the end of the world.
No. And sometimes around here, you get teachers that do have a little bit more creativity and willingness to introduce new things and not be sticking with quite all the traditions.
Both Grandin and Creer studied psychology when they started college and experienced the value of a diverse education and mentoring.
One of the reasons I started in psychology is it didn't have a whole lot of math requirements. And I was very, very interested in visual perception, optical illusions. In the HBO movie, they showed me making that optical illusion room. Well, all that interest in visual perception helped me in my work with cattle because I looked at what they were looking at.
Right.
No shadow would make them refuse to go through a facility.
For me, too, it's actually proved to be very helpful. All of the things I've studied, which had nothing to do with agriculture,
you can get so narrow. Yeah. Isaac Asimov, the great science writer, he said, a degree. It's the first step down a ruinous highway. and you don't want to waste it. So you go on for a master's degree, a PhD, and you end up being a thoroughgoing ignoramus about everything in the world except for one subdivisional sliver of nothing.
That's great.
And I was at a crop science meeting probably about 5 years ago where I gave my different kinds of minds talk. Talked to a bunch of professors and scientists in the poster room, and they were telling me that some of their straight-A students had no creativity. They weren't creative in thinking up things to study. And I'm worried today, there's some states are worse than others, getting so rigid that a lot of creative kids are just getting screened out. And I'd be one of them.
Right.
There's certain states where I wouldn't graduate from high school. And I've often thought about what would I do? Now, I know what I would do if someone waved a magic wand and I was 18 coming out of a low-income background. I would know how to get ahead in a corporation. But if I had my knowledge, because I know how to move inside a big corporation.
But that worries me too. I see a lot of our educational system really pushing for people, like for students to choose one thing and to, you know, they have to stick with it and they're supposed to identify their career. I mean, I have young children that were supposed to identify their, like they made them do a 20-year plan, you know, and all this and that. And I think it's kind of a shame to not just give people permission to explore.
Well, what I'm telling people, what I'm finding, I've looked into the history of a lot of very, very successful people. Mm-hmm. Let's take Michelangelo. 12 years old, he dropped out of school, did not want to study Latin, did not want to become a lawyer. Dirty, slobby little kid.
Uh-huh.
Little kid. And all right, what helped him to be successful? He was exposed to great art. Every church was commissioning it.
Right.
He also grew up using stone cutting tools. That's the exposure.
Wow.
And then later on, people size talent and mentors sort of coming out of the wood. Then the mentors come out of the woodwork when they see the talent. It starts out with exposure and then mentoring. Really important. If you don't get exposed to something, you're not going to get interested in it. Yeah. Or you might get exposed to something and just hate it.
Uh-huh.
Also important to find out what you hate too. Well, I guess we're going to have to get going. I've got to get on and do some other things, like pay bills that have been sitting around for a week. Okay, well, I'm going to take off, and it's been really, really wonderful talking to you.
Thank you so much. It's been so wonderful. Thank you for all your insight.
That was Temple Grandin and Aaron Creer.
Thank you so much for listening.
How Do You Think of That is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center in partnership with SQ Media. Music production by Rebecca Baker.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grant number 174-5674.